small in presence, but if we add it to the people in the phone, we have a good core of our group for our November 17th meeting. I do want to make a couple of introductions. Andrew Kaza has joined us on behalf of the Independent Party of Oregon. He has replaced their appointment of Rob Harris and has started to participate in our discussions, was in on one of our small group discussions. And here's Seth, who has now arrived in the room. We have Seth and Norm and Senator Boquist, Andrew Kaza, Nikki Fisher, and Dave Ellis. We know that there have been four at any one time on the phone. Senator Rosenbaum, Brad Martin, let's say again, Daniel Lukow, and Kyle Markley on the phone. We will not have Representatives Kenemer or Rayfield, unfortunately, and Justin Delaney last night let us know he had a little crisis to take care of. So we will be a little bit of a smaller group today. Also, I do want to introduce Steve Trout, who is here as a representative of the Secretary-elect Richardson's transition team. And so I've obviously let them know about the meetings that will come the second or the first of January. I'll be ending my tenure as Secretary of State, and Secretary Richardson will take over. And so they're trying to get up to speed on lots of different things, as you can well imagine. And so we're into the transition time. I appreciate Steve being here and listening in to see kind of where we've been and where we might be going. Our informational meeting today is focused on, in particular, the three areas of exploration that we broke into some smaller groups. Thank you for those of you who participated in some of our discussions. You have written notes from those meetings, and what I would hope to accomplish today is to get together a list of those things which we might want to make as recommendations, some of which might need to be drafted in legislation, and we'll try to figure out what the vehicles we have between members of the task force and Secretary of State, who, although I'll be going away, I do have the ability to pre-session file some things, and I do have some working drafts that potentially can be added to. So, you know, there are patterns for that. But more important at this point, I think, is looking at what recommendations that you want to go in a report. We're not required to do a report at this time, but it seems appropriate to at the beginning of the session to let legislative leadership know what things there have been some agreement on. And just to remind you, we will continue to have the history of our other report. We can reiterate some of that, some or all of that information in our recommendations. What we were asked by legislative leadership as we came in out of the last session and came into this year's worth of work was to see if there were items on which we could find more than a bare majority of agreement that might move forward. It's still okay for us to have recommendations that we have already had that are, you know, very close calls, but those decisions about what those recommendations will be some potential drafts of what those might look like will be considered in our December meeting. And today is to kind of get that list ready for that activity. Does that all make some sense?
It does. Just one point, Madam Secretary. I have to leave a little after 10 for a transportation committee, and so I won't be here.
Transportation just trumps everything.
I'm just saying.
No pun intended.
No, Matt. And I will be here in the next session, despite the best efforts of some people. And
no one at this table, thank you.
And to that and everybody at the table, as was raised at the beginning of the last session, if there's a majority or a minority report or draft legislation or even an entity in here that's participated and has a minority view, my office is open to sponsoring legislative drafts for you, whether I agree or disagree. So just keep that in mind. There will be a mechanism regardless for all and everyone's ideas. So if you have something that just reach out to my office, and we'll ensure it gets drafted so you can see it in that format. And by the way, I routinely sponsor legislation I do vote against.
So don't read too much into it.
But it is not a free-for-all, Madam Secretary.
Oh, gosh, that's too bad. Are there other questions about our sort of where we are and what our processes are? Hello, Daniel. Welcome. I would like to take...
Who's on the phone again, please?
We have on the phone Senator Rosenbaum, Brad Martin, Kyle Markley. Daniel was on the phone, but he arrived, and we appreciate appreciate that. And Andrew, would you like an identification of where all these people are from, or which who are their representatives?
Oh, sure, that'd be helpful.
Yes. Daniel Andrew is the new representative for the Independent Party of Oregon. You may remember we had very specified membership for the task force in our legislation, and it was my choice that each of the parties that was to be represented would make their own designation of who they would like to have represented, and so they're making a switch in the Independent Party, and Andrew is now there. But if others want to introduce themselves, go ahead. Let's go around the table first so that Andrew knows.
I'm Norman Turrell. I'm the president of the League of Women Voters of Oregon.
I'm Seth Woolley, representing the Pacific Green Party and the Progressive Party.
I'm Daniel Lukow, representing Common Cause Oregon.
I'm State Senator Brian Boquist, and I am on the Rules Committee, which will hear whatever comes out.
Dave Ellis, representing non-affiliated voters.
Nikki Fisher, Executive Director of the Oregon Bus Project.
All right. And I'm Andrew Cousin from Independent Party, replacing Rob Harris.
Wonderful. And on the phone, Kyle, you want to introduce yourself to Andrew?
Yeah, hello. This is Kyle Markley. I'm the nominee from the Libertarian Party.
And Brad?
It's Brad Martin, Executive Director of the Democratic Party of Oregon.
Yes. Margie Hughes was going to be away for this meeting. We knew that before, so if you're trying to identify where and who are there, we haven't heard from either Serena or Rob Ratio at this point. They're a nonprofit organization and a second non-affiliated voter. And Justin Delaney, who was pointed to us by a number of the major business organizations, is not able to be here as well, but he's been a very active participant in the task force. So get used to introducing yourself. You'll have a new secretary to have to do that all with again, assuming you all feel and the secretary feels there is still work to be done and utility to finishing out. The legislation does last through the end of June of 2017. So I want to take a little chair's privilege, if I could, only just because in terms of discussion glow and what issues are going to take what time. Would people mind if we started with the second bullet first and do the political tax credit before we do public financing? Is that problematic for anybody who needs to leave sooner or anything like that? Thank you. Again, I really appreciate the participation, and several of the people who aren't here today were pretty active participants in the small groups, so that feels good in terms of having had to, you know, the opportunity to give some input into these this discussion. So you have the notes in front of you. I won't read them all, but just to note that the group saw that the political tax credit had some real assets to it. It's something that people participate in voluntarily. It's a way individually for candidates and others to approach people and ask them to participate in a small way. That probably encourages them to then follow through and both vote or maybe get involved in other campaigns. And, you know, obviously can be meaningful to folks who don't can't or don't want to donate large amounts. And as I say, has that kind of direct engagement piece of it. I know that was a big issue for Representative Kennemer, who felt like it was really a valuable part of his bringing people together when he formed his campaigns. We did have, as we do in the task force, some philosophical issues around how that use of that sort of general fund government spending, which a tax credit always results in, is in fact one person subsidizing another's political voice, and that has a philosophical challenge to it for some of the folks on the task force. Great concern, I think, a fairly united concern that because it is now means tested, it really narrows the group for whom it becomes an incentive to participate. Justin has raised the issue of whether there may be even a constitutional issue with in this case in terms of being discriminatory as to who can use the tax credit and who cannot. Pointed out that it's not refundable, so that means that lowest income Oregonians will have less incentive to participate, and that the amount hasn't been updated for many years. I think we discussed 60-something was when it was first passed and has been the same since that time. We did have conversations about how this compares back and forth between a checkoff, $2 for political campaigning sort of thing, and vouchers, which may have a similar incentive if they're small, like the ones in Seattle where it's $50 for $50 vouchers that you might have to do things with. There was conversation about, if you do put yourself into a checkoff, you don't really know who's going to get that money. So you're giving up some of your control as an individual in going to that kind of system. And then I think the other big thing around vouchers that was discussed to some degree is that it is a more complex program to manage. It will take some administration that is not necessarily built in currently. And would have to do that. So before I go any further, for those who weren't part of that discussion, does any of this strike you as not the right thing to worry about, or other things that you feel like we missed? That would be a.
I'd be curious to hear a little bit more about the constitutionality question.
So we did, and I will just say as follow-up, we did. You'll see at the bottom that there were some things that the folks asked to have a little more information about. That was one piece of a question that we did place to Legislative Revenue to give us just the top of the head. They didn't have to research a bunch of things or listen to all the tapes or anything, but just give us as Legislative Revenue staff some background on how that decision was arrived at to do the means testing. According to Chris Alanak, who you may remember did our presentation around the tax and is the person in legislative revenue who does that, the issue of constitutionality did not come up at all. It would have been something in normal circumstances, Ledge Council would raise that. Many of the tax credits are means tested, and so I don't think there was any red flag or alarm that went off in their minds. Justin, I think, has the perspective that potentially because this is a sort of a speech affected, related thing, that the means testing may have some additional constitutional challenges. As I say, that was not something that Ledge Council had flagged or had a concern about at the time that they went to that. We could try to get some kind of an opinion on the matter if we, but it felt to me from the group like there was more support to try to go away from means testing than there was to try to defend it. I mean the desire to get more people participating and to make it more broadly available and perhaps help candidates and campaigns have a broader group to reach out to than just the people who are used to writing checks. That it would be, so we didn't get hung up on whether we wanted to you know, strike it down as unconstitutional. The other information Chris provided, you know, as often happens in the legislature, there are pots of money and there are lists, and there was a certain amount of money for tax credits, and it probably was smaller than it had been, because and with an asking the Revenue Committee to make some efforts to reduce the use of credits of various kinds, there was good support for the credit itself. Many other things were means tested. It was a way at arriving at a revenue result, not necessarily done for a policy reason of, you know, but I think probably feeling defensible in the standpoint that some of us can better afford to give a $50 without a credit than others.
Since I was
this
one of the...
This is Anne. Could I just interject?
Please go ahead, Heather.
Yeah, Diane and then Brian, yeah.
Okay, so I just want to put a little context around this. I think that summary was excellent. I was chairing the Rules Committee in 2013 when we reviewed this credit. And just to put it in context, you know, this credit was by no means singled out. The legislature has for several years now put a sunset on every tax credit so that each tax credit comes up for a review at its sunset looming, and so a policy committee as well as the revenue committee look at every single one, and then the guidelines are, you know, is it performing its stated purpose? Are there ways that it can be changed or improved? And does it fit against the budget constraints? So that was the context in which it was looked at 2013. I think Erin was staffing the committee on both sides, so she probably remembers this well, but we did have significant testimony about the political tax credit, and, you know, although there was some sentiment it should just be eliminated altogether, overwhelmingly people wanted to keep it, but there was a lot of testimony about means testing it as a way of directing it to the people that it is supposed to be encouraging to participate. So I did want to put that in, even though I wasn't in the small group, because while the hearings were going on, the press was also weighing in very strongly. You know, I think some of the press would have said just do away with it because we had a serious budget hole to fill. But the place where the legislature ended up was that means testing it was a good way of making sure that it was still there for middle and lower income people, because that is one of the goals that it lets people participate who couldn't afford to otherwise. So I say that because I think to go away from means testing would be a significant 180-degree turnaround, which I would find that strange to do and wouldn't personally support it.
Thank you, Senator. And Senator, that you were nodding, so there was some of that you...
Madam Secretary, and to follow up on Senator Rosenbaum's, because I was one of the people that was in the decision loop, because in my other hat, I'm the Vice Chair of Revenue and Finance in the Senate, which, you know, is a strange structure, which means anything that has revenue must have bipartisan support just to get to the numbers that are required. And as Senator Rosenbaum said, just to be very clear, this tax credit is not going away. I'll just be blunt. Okay. The votes don't exist for it to go away. Exactly what Senator Rosenbaum raised in terms of means testing was applied to every tax credit across the board. It also has to do with filing issues, because how you file in the paperwork process costs us money. And I can tell you the cost savings of streamlining in our filing process more than makes up any amount of money that's ever claimed on this particular tax credit across the board. The one thing that has happened in it is we continue to try and streamline the tax credit process. And this is one in the Revenue Committee, like in the Rules Committee. I mean, there was really, other than marginal opposition to it, it's how it's applied across the board and utilized. It certainly can be improved. And I see some recommendations down here. But just to be the two things that probably are impossible, because it's been applied as a set of rules, at least by the five angry white men who are on the Senate Revenue Committee, as they call us, is that, you know, refundability and means testing become very problematic to administer. And so you have to kind of keep everything in the same box. If you make an exception for one, it suddenly starts costing you a ton of money in the processing on the other side. So I just, for bluntness, say, you know, I cannot imagine means testing going away, and I cannot imagine making it refundable only because of the application and the processing process would be more expensive than any merit we would have on the opposite side. So,
let me just be clear that I understand refundability has an administrative cost. Means testing also has an administrative cost.
What we've done is we've tried to unify the processing system. And why means testing is being applied across the board, it matters which form you file, how the computer program is set up, and everything else along that line. Okay. And so you can't just, if you just take one item and say, this tax credit is going to be means tested, if you can just imagine, it's like OrStar. It's a computer system. Mm-hmm. An expensive computer system, which you all know failed the first time, and we're now spending more money to do the second time. And so that becomes, that is one of the probabilities and problems with it, is that when you separate one out, when we're decided we're going to go, you know, means testing is the way we're going to do it, that's how you file, that's how you do it, that's how you verify it. You can do all of the forms and all the tax credits that way, and if you have one exception, you now you have to add a line to make the exception. And it might seem simple to you to add a line on a piece of paper or add a computer line, but it costs millions of dollars to do that. Which is why we've uniformly taken the position that, okay, we either are or we aren't, and we've decided we are for revenue purposes, not related to this. And so everybody's going to go that way. As we march down the road and we're reviewing these every 2 years, we're going to do them all that direction so that we don't end up with a dual-pronged process that costs us more money.
Norm.
I wanted to say that I like the tax credit a lot as far as it goes. But the non-refundability, of course, is a problem because it's really targeted at the people who can least afford to make a campaign contribution, and those are the ones that would benefit from.
Are you able to hear Norm well enough on the phone?
Not very.
Okay, we're going to move towards. We're working on our system.
So the I like it a lot, and I think it should stay in place for now. The non-refundability is a problem because it's the purpose is to get involved the people who really can least otherwise afford to make a campaign contribution. And the other problem with the tax credit is that the reward, if you will, for making a campaign contribution doesn't come until maybe a year later after making the contribution. And so that separation makes it problematic, or there's very little motivation, really, for somebody that doesn't have a lot of money to make a campaign contribution. So ultimately, I think a better public financing system would be some sort of matching fund for small contributions, like has been proposed at the city council in Portland, which is looking seriously at a 6-to-1 match like they have used for years in New York City. And I'm not saying we should propose that to the legislature now. It's problematic getting any funds out of the legislature right now, given the campaign, the revenue crunch and the failure of Measure 97. But eventually I think we would do better with some sort of matching fund for candidates and ballot measures and maybe organizations.
And we will have a further discussion about the public financing things when we get to that one as good. Well. So, and I do think there is some compare and contrast that people are, you know, quite making. Andrew, did you have something?
Yes, Madam Secretary, I was curious, since I wasn't part of that subgroup, and I don't know if this was raised, but I don't see it in the notes. Does the Department of Revenue have statistics as to the actual utilization of the credit? Do we have some kind of a trend line on that?
We do have a report, which was in earlier materials.
Oh, okay, okay.
And,
so I've missed that. Sorry.
And I'll make sure to point you to where that is on our in our stuff. I can actually hand you mine for the moment. We are only going to begin to see, I think, out of this tax year, the full effect of what means testing did in terms of Of course, what they're measuring is lost revenue, you know, the amount that the credit was chosen. I remember feeling embarrassed that I was among those who didn't know it was being means tested and sort of challenged my accountant last month, just how come my, you know, I hand her a stack of receipts for my political giving and said, you know, I don't even get $50 back. And yep, that's right, you know. In future years, I might be back in the situation where I do, but with my husband and I both... together, not. But here's the report, if I could get that back.
Okay, thanks. I apologize for dredging up if it was ground covered before.
That's quite thanks. All right. I think what we, if I could be so bold as to summarize, and you all will correct me, what we found is that the history of it had been used by filers in higher income categories more often than lower income categories, and that didn't surprise anybody. I don't think that was the case, but we weren't able yet to see the full effect of means testing and whether that meant more or less. It tended to be used much more strongly in presidential years than in others, which also shouldn't be too much of a surprise. So it is up for review again in 2019. Although they could take it up and do a review again at any point, as my understanding from the legislative revenue staff. I'd like to just lay out the argument, if I can do so, for distinguishing it. Obviously, you know, a fiscal impact would have an impact no matter what. And I have asked legislative revenue, and they do think they can get us an estimate before our next meeting, if we did any or all of the three things that are on that list, removing the means testing. Making it refundable or increasing to a 75, 150, which was the other thought that had come up at our table. So we should be able to see at least what the revenue impact would be of those things, and again would have to be complemented by what Senator Boquiston has indicated in terms of the complexity to the revenue department and what the administrative costs would look like. I think that the part of the sense that I got out of the discussion was that while focusing on allowing lower income folks to participate was one good goal, getting anybody to participate at the individual level as opposed to at the $5,000 check or, you know, putting my money in a pack or, you know, the more engaged level that some people are was in and of itself a potential benefit that it, you know, if in fact it was noted, I think, in our discussion that the tax credit was quite often used by groups on the right and the left, or however we want to say, progressive and otherwise, where they were raising a lot of money in individual donations from folks. Not so much, I think, Justin talked about the business community feeling like it's not an effective way to raise money within their community because it doesn't have that same impact. But we did, I think, all have a little bit of a positive view of, you know, any, and I kind of wish Representative Kennemer were here to speak to this because it was kind of an important issue, that any effort that encourages individual people to make individual decisions about, you know, writing a check at a $75 level or a $50 level is a benefit to the system. So I just want to make sure that point is.
Can I just add one thing? So I think making it refundable has a lot of strengths to the program. It does expand who's able to participate in it. And I believe Minnesota does a really good job of this because what they do is now they make it refundable, but they make it refundable far earlier than April. So low-income people have the ability to take advantage of it and then they see their money return at a quicker pace. And for someone living paycheck to paycheck, that matters a lot. So I think Minnesota has actually seen a higher rate of people using it, because not only is it refundable, but it's also refundable at an earlier fashion than other ones would be. So I think Oregon could really benefit by looking at that.
Go ahead.
Dean, this is Brad.
Brad, go ahead.
Yeah, I think you've done a really excellent summary, and you know, both as a policy issue and in the context of the current politics and revenue. I think our baseline coming out of the committee was this tax credit enjoys support. It may not be perfect, but it's good, and it incentivizes participation. And like any tax incentive, it doesn't necessarily reach everybody perfectly, but it reaches a large group of people. And in kind of an ordered way of thinking, in my mind, it's, well, one, given the revenue forecast, it might well be purposeful that this committee endorses what we have. I'm strongly interested in both refundability and looking at increasing the tax credit, and that may not be practical in this session, but it seems to me that you know, we definitely want to talk, we want to come together around what we want to argue for in this session, but I would not make small the notion that as a fairly diverse group, if there's a general support that's, you know, more than kind of a just a majority, and it sounds like we've had that based on the subgroup, that's no small thing to assert, that this is something important to our political culture. It's not perfect, but it's awfully good. And, you know, these are paths we might want to look at in proving it. I'm not terribly enthusiastic about looking at this in the in the form of this costs money. This is the dollar amount it costs us under the current system, and would we want to rejigger things to either add in refundability without increasing cost or without dramatically increasing cost? And I think that kind of becomes, in my mind, the central question when we come back together in December is, do those estimates tell us something about some possibility that is worth arguing for on top of what we currently have? But like I said, I think the most compelling lesson out of the subgroup was pretty strong, pretty across the political spectrum belief that this is not perfect, but it's a good part of our system, and we ought to continue it and actually look on expanding it. I don't think anybody argued on, you know, getting rid of it, or if they did, they didn't do so vocally.
I think that's true, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. Senator Boquist here for who's ever on the phone. I guess let me ask the group a question, because this is going to come to me unless something changes, and it's going to be a revenue issue after it comes out of the political side, which I guess I'll be there too, Madam Counsel. Things to consider for your consideration. First off, this is a legislature, and just because it might sound stupid, don't ignore it, okay? My suggestion is whatever you want to do, you do it in a list order. Like, you know, we'd like to do all three, and here's our priority. I will tell you just right off the bat that the amount of increasing it in your first tier here, the simplest, most effective, easiest to administer, and cheapest is simply increase the value of the credit, okay? I'll just tell you that. 75, 150, or whatever. That's the easiest to implement, I tell you. And that's how the Revenue Committee will approach it. The refundability, here's two options that are out there that you can consider, and the reason I say you should put it on a list of what are your priorities, one, two, three, is that short of refundability, it can be made into a carry-forward credit. Okay, we do that with a kicker. It's already in the computer system. That's not ideal, but I'm just telling you, if you said we wanted refundability and the committee got it and looked at it and said it's a good idea but we can't do it, it could easily be converted into a carry-forward credit. Second thing that you might sound is very strange to you, but this is how revenue works, welcome to politics, is that we have been working and waiting for the next economic downturn to be able to make the earned income tax credit, which is the low income piece, quarterly and refundable. We have not had the political will to do that yet because we haven't met the right crisis. Now, I'll just point this out to you. The crisis might come in the next market downturn, and if we made the earned income tax credit refundable, the lower income individuals at a quarterly basis would be receiving money back. They might not get the tax credit back, but it might help address the issues psychologically and financially that you were talking about. And then the third thing, I mean, I would not discredit means testing. As I pointed out, it's just a very problematic at our site. So I would encourage the committee, whatever you decide to do, I mean, just put them in a priority. Don't say, don't allow the revenue and the rules committee to pick, well, we want three, not one. Make sure whatever recommendation, this is number one priority, this is number two priority, this is number three priority, because that's how we work out there. When we sit down, is, you know, I can tell you what happens to number
most?
Three. Yeah, what do you want most? I can tell you what happened to number three right off the bat. But that's just the way it's sort of going to work. So I think there's opportunity, and just because it's a low-income season, you have to remember, just look at Portlandia right now and look at all the political discussion amongst the variety of parties that are sitting here right now. So politics is fresh in everybody's mind, and it's a good crisis in the legislature to make things happen. So I would encourage you to at least make a recommendation of one of these three, or if not all three of these items.
And Gene, to that point, and I think it's something we didn't talk about is, and I know how hard something that sounds easy can be. It might be worth asking the appropriate department for what the costs of making these changes are, not in terms of revenue costs, but actually, as pointed out, the cost of administering.
Right.
You know, may drive our thinking, and also it obviously would be something that we might as well get ahead of.
Well, I think that's wise to have that additional conversation, and I thank the two senators for raising it. Appreciate that. I would also recommend, I'm sensing that it would be appropriate to develop a resolution around this, this topic. When we get there, people, if they really do feel like the political tax credit is a bad idea, that'll be their time to say, never mind, I don't want to have anything about it in the report. But in addition to whatever potential legislation our ideas could come attached to, given that the tax is due to be reviewed in the next legislative session after that, I think the more we can express what, as Brad indicated, a multi-political, you know, voice had around it will help them. You probably, Senator Rosenbaum and others in the policy committee, had some more discussion. The revenue staff's perception was there wasn't a lot of discussion in revenue, and maybe it's not, you know, they're looking to the policy commission to have a committee to have that discussion, but their sense was, if you remember from Chris Allenack's report to us, was kind of like, we don't have a really strong justification for this tax in our report, the report that kind of gets updated every time they review one of these. And I think we can perform a good value for that review coming up in 2019 if this group has some, you know, has a pretty good resolution around the issues that we see attached to it. And that may have, you know, it's certainly my hope that our reports will have some vitality beyond what legislation gets passed in 2017 or even in 2019 in terms of going back to what's the politically possible, what are the things people were most concerned about with these issues. So that would be my pitch for having and I think I would, Aaron and I would work on, you know, drafting something that would maybe pull a few pieces apart so people could vote separately on it. But.
Well, Madam Secretary, mm-hmm. I can tell you why there was no discussion, because Chair Haas and I said we're going to do it.
No.
So there's no need for discussion. I would go farther as to, I mean, and it's written here, I don't know what the order was in the deal, of just to saying that A, B, C, and D, sub 4 A, B, C, and D ought to just be put in priority 1, 2, and 3, and 4, mm-hmm. and so that the legislature, at least the revenue side, has some indication of what it is the group wants in that priority order. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether you want 75, 150, or 100, 200. I mean, being a revenue, neither one of these bother me at all. I mean, this is not that big of a issue. We can always find 100 million here or 100 million there. It'd be funny to find out that we'll fight over 900,000 for 6 weeks, but we can find 100 million easy.
All
And this isn't
bites over 50,000, so I.
You can't. I'm considered the most credible senator.
The press is in the room, so please, so, you know, if you want to be.
So here's my recommendation: that you use priorities in 1 through 4, and it's. And I don't care if somebody changes the priority; that's just a starting point.
And Madam Secretary, just to jump in again, and I don't want to belabor this because I know we need to move on. I would really urge us not to tinker with this credit too much, given that it was just rejiggered in 2013 and isn't scheduled for review again until 2019. Although I do like the idea of making sure that the write-up in the, I forget what the book is called that comes out every 2 years along with the budget
tax
that reviews all the tax credits.
Tax expenditures book.
And that analysis does come from the agency that implements each of those credits. So mm-hmm. So I think some of this discussion sure could be reflected in that book.
Well, I can actually tell you that it should be. This is the one credit that my agency is asked about. When it first got the question about it, it wasn't specified, and I wrestled a little bit, and my deputy wrestled a little bit of whether we had any input into this. And it really was a result of the discussion that the small group had that I said, wait a minute, I would like to. And so we did add some narrative back that, in fact, made reference to the task force and the evaluation that was happening about it. So we've at least, you know, got that started as that this could become the record that we operate.
Right. And so. My final comment on this, putting on my other hat, which is as a member of the Hunger Task Force, is that because Senator Boquist correctly mentioned the earned income credit, that is actually a refundable credit in Oregon now, but there has been an ongoing effort on the part of low-income advocates to increase the portion that's refundable, and we have increased it somewhat in a previous revenue reform package. So I think one thing to think about is I doubt very much that making the political tax credit refundable is a very high priority for those who advocate primarily for low-income folks. And I think the reason it's not is because it's just not used much by that population. And you can see why, because if you can't buy food, how likely are you going to be to contribute $50 or $100 to a political campaign? So I tend to think, although it's beyond the scope of this group, that would not be, you know, it would not be a high priority for a broad spectrum of people who advocate for that community.
Thank you. There are priorities and priorities. That's true.
Also,
Nikki.
One of the things, too, that I think is really important for us to think about initially is when we met together the first time, and I apologize that you weren't here, but we came up with the problems, of, like the perceived problems out by the outside. And I would just echo the senator's comments that I think that this is not one of the big issues that when we ask young voters what issues they care about, this is the perceived problem is maybe not the tax credit, but larger problem as a whole. So I would just echo that as well.
Okay, well, thank you. Well, we will try to construct one or maybe two or, you know, something that gives some alternatives. And, of course, there'll be editing it from the floor, I'm quite sure, as we go through that. But we'll have something along this line here. And Representative Kenmore has a strong interest in this, as I indicated, and he may want to. I'll urge him to communicate with you all if he has that So would we? And I guess I at some point we will need to have Elsie kind of weigh in on whether or not the current means testing is something constitutionally challengeable. I don't know whether there's anybody's out there that's seeking to do it. And again, I think the argument is. And Justin isn't here to make it for himself, so he might have a different way of saying it, but that because it's sort of a rewarding speech of a kind that has a different thing than some of the other tax provisions. That's my best estimate of what that argument is. But we can look at that so we can either put that issue to rest or understand it when we make our recommendations. Okay, so we'd like to move to public financing. One of the things, reasons that we put tax credit on the table was we had a, as you know, a little mixed reaction. Thank you, Senator Boquist, and we'll look for your your input as we move forward. Going to do roads, yeah. And I know that Senator Rosenbaum also has some meeting with governors and other folks coming up this afternoon, I'm sure, about some other key issues. The building is beginning to buzz, as it always does a week after election. So our discussion about public financing, to back up a second, we had put the political tax credit on the radar as something we wanted to kind of resolve feelings about, in part because it is an alternative way to have the state support political activity, as tax expenditures always are. And there was, for those who had a little more skepticism around public financing, the tax credit argument, you know, did weigh a little heavier. So with that in mind, the discussion on public financing, again, was good. We have had a couple of different presentations about models that are out there. Andrew and others that may not have seen those. We do have, as you know, the city of Portland, I know that Daniel and his group have been working with them on their potential vote by city council, which may be coming up in this month, and we'll want to kind of, you know, recognize that. But we discussed, you know, again, the notion of using public financing is that it broadens the support that's given to candidates away from the traditional donors and particularly the large ones that are seen as having more influence than perhaps is justified in our system. Jurisdictions are seeing as a way to campaign finance. So because of the barriers that there have been or perceived barriers that there are because of Supreme Court decisions around limiting on the large end, the many more jurisdictions are beginning to look at the public financing piece as an alternative way to address that. We do have some history, particularly in New York, around it having expanded a little bit around the diversity of candidates over time. And there was a cross-section of support at various levels for potentially a public financing program from the group, so it seemed worth pursuing a little bit more. We did have four members who are firmly will not be supportive of that, and I think the reasons vary a little bit. Some of it may be as much political realities, and whether that group within our group has expanded because of budget challenges, I don't know. Again, I urge just to look at, you know, even if we can do resolutions that encourage X, Y, and Z in looking at these things, we will have made some, had some voice in what might happen down the line. On the negative side, we have a little historical baggage in Oregon because of the challenges that happened around the earlier Portland program. The competition with general fund programs and the perception problem that at a time when we may be having programs may be starving for dollars or getting cut, we're giving money for politicians to use. And that just kind of general concept would be difficult. And an understanding that this would be something that would take a program administration initiative that would be relatively significant. It's not something that can just be built on top of the systems that we have. We talked through the various options based on models that are out there, either in implementation or in process of implementation, vouchers, grants, which could be matching, grants that are not matching. We talked about sources of funds. And that was where we actually had a little bit more of a conversation about tax form checkoff. Can we voluntarily build a fund while by people, you know, having, you know, it does redistribute tax dollars they're paying, so it's not necessarily revenue, you know, neutral. It doesn't, you know, I suppose it could be built so that it added dollars to what you were paying in a tax, but at any rate, we'd have to work through that. I did, just for purposes of discussion, I had asked to understand a little better than I did what the realities were in terms of general, in terms of fees and fines that are paid to the Secretary of State's office, and in terms of filing fees that come to the Secretary of State's office. And I had learned preliminarily, at least, that, well, and have confirmed and do understand now that those dollars go directly to the general fund, that they do not come, you know, they pass through the Secretary of State's office as an administrative matter, but they are considered general fund, and they aren't present as part of the Secretary of State's budget. I asked to know sort of how much we had passed through to the general fund over, you know, recent biennia, and the amounts were $881,000 in one, $825,000 and another $935,000 in the most recent biennium, as we estimated to get out to 2017. So that's, you know, we're up in the close to $1 million a biennium at least would have a tie to the activity that we would be seeking to fund, and might have, you know, some attraction because of that. Doesn't get us to a 6-to-1 match on every state race, even with a small grant program. You know, it would not buy a lot to do that, but it was the one and only, I think, idea that got to the table that, you know, would be a source other than, and it still would be a general fund source because it would remove general fund from what's now going. Whether there are other ideas that people have about less difficult funds to access, you know, more, again, building a fund of some kind that could be independent of the general fund and not feel as if we're competing with key state programs. We did not have any of additional ones on the table. And then we did have a pretty good discussion of, you know, if it was a state program, what kinds of candidates would it include? Obviously, the more candidate categories it includes, the more expensive it would be. We had a pretty good discussion of, would it be possible to pilot, you know, that you could pick 6 legislative districts out of a hat, and those would be my sense, and I'll just speak for myself here, and I couldn't imagine the resentment and they got to and I didn't, or they had to and I didn't, and what that could come out of that. That would seem very difficult. We thought perhaps a category, maybe starting with judges first as opposed to going right to legislators, or you take the 4 statewide offices, given that that's where a lot of the most visible debate around a big $300,000 check lands in one or the other, that tends to create that public perception that we're trying to get around. So we didn't, you know, really land there. But I think we have identified sort of what the debate points are. I think we do know from the presentation that we got and from the various experiences in other states that there are models worth additional, you know, consideration. But I do think everybody felt a little bit constrained by the politics of the moment, you know, in Oregon. And we might well conclude, well, I won't do that. You guys talk, and then we'll see what you conclude from that discussion about. And again, think about, we can make strong statements about things that don't involve, designing a program and having it, written in legislation. So I just want us to look at the range of options. Yeah. Andrew, you're looking thoughtful. Do you have something?
I guess one quick point I'd make. First of all, for the record, I was part of that last group, even though I'm not listed at the top of it.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. I also wonder if the landscape's changed a little bit. I mean, for all of us, relative to, forget the national result, but just what went on in Multnomah County and the overwhelming support given might sort of give one pause for thought around some of these things.
89%.
Yeah. I mean, what do we have 89% on anything anymore? So that's sort of what's occurring to me in the first instance here as it relates to this point, because
I think it's a good idea to talk a little bit about that. Of course, the Multnomah County one wasn't a public financing program.
No.
It was the very much what this, by a small majority, this task force put forward last time in terms of limits, although we didn't have expenditure limits in ours. So it was focused on that, and I do think when we get to the end, we should talk again about that whole piece too.
But I think it also is kind of operating hand in glove with what the city of Portland is debating again, which is obviously a public financing sort of initiative again. So it just seems to me there is quite a groundswell right now, and you could if you want. Marry it back on the national level and say, there's a movement for reform around the country, however you want to sort of pose it. So I guess I mention that only because when we're talking about the politics of some of these things and how I think when we had the call, I was one of the ones advocating actually for what you said would be very politically difficult, which is the notion of trialing this in smaller legislative races. I think it could be achievable. And I think anything bigger than that busts the budget in the short term and becomes a little bit of a political nightmare from just a financial standpoint, a revenue standpoint. That's going to be the overriding issue the state's dealing with over the next few years is our fiscal crisis, if you will. And so I think whatever we try to do in this realm needs to be seen as kind of small and manageable in the near term.
Yeah, I think, if you broke it down into, different hats, for instance, or you had, different categories for different legislative districts. So you had, based on where the population often resides, so you had one for, the city of Portland, one for the suburbs of Portland, just because there's such a huge part of our population there, one for medium to small-sized cities, so, Salem, Eugene, Bend, one for Southern Oregon, one for Eastern Oregon, and one for the coast, and just kind of out of those, pulled out something out of a hat, and then had a chance to run those programs in different communities and see where where they're successful and what percentage of people take advantage of it.
Or you could also look at the costs of the campaigns relative to the affordability of this thing, because we all know if you're trying to buy ads in the Portland market, it's quite a bit more prohibitive than Bend. Where I am right now, I'm seeing Newt Bueller and Gina, his opponent's ads every other second in the month leading up to the election, because Newt's million-dollar war chest goes a lot further than it would in any other market in the state in Bend. But I think if you looked at some of the smaller legislative districts in terms of the cost, you could run a sort of a 10-year expenditure report and figure out the ones that might marry up, and you'd probably get a nice cross section around the state, because I don't think people are spending tons of money everywhere.
And I think that's true, because you don't want to, I think a trap to avoid would be just trying in a certain part of the state,
right?
Where I think if it's not successful, if it is successful, people can believe the results are skewed because of local dynamics.
Right.
Whereas
right.
If you try in all different communities, you can see if it really does work. And we could look at the average cost of a legislative race in these different communities and see would we be providing enough money for them to actually run competitive campaigns? Could they buy TV? Could they buy mail?
Right.
Could they hire a campaign manager under it? Because it has to be real. I mean, because they're optional, you can't force candidates to participate in public financing. It has to the program has to be realistic enough that candidates would want to opt into the program.
Right.
So I think, like, yeah, looking at different population districts all over the state could be a really good way of, like, getting a sense of where people really respond to it.
Madam Secretary, can I jump in?
Absolutely, Diane.
And I was on this subcommittee, and just a couple of things. I think, one, our subcommittee was pretty small, you know, in proportion to the number of people on the task force who had expressed interest in working on this. And so I think it's particularly important to get feedback from the full task force on these recommendations. I will just play devil's advocate about what's just been discussed about piloting in certain legislative districts. It's too bad there aren't any other legislators, I don't think, still in the room or on the phone, but I continue to believe, and I, you know, we can test this with others, that it would be very, very difficult to figure out how to select a small number of districts, and that if, because we're talking about recommendations to the legislature, that that could become the political football that just tanks the entire proposal, because, you know, it's very much in the eye of the beholder what is a competitive district, and that varies from one cycle to another too. So I just, you know, I don't mean to be a naysayer, but I think that would be a really, really hard sell in the legislative process to try to figure that out. Or I was just thinking, like, could you set some objective criteria? But even that, I think, becomes hard. And so part of our discussion in the subgroup also went to, could we do a category of statewide offices, you know, just so that we would be able to have something available to everybody who ran for a particular set of offices, as opposed to having to worry about some, you know, districts complaining that they weren't eligible while others were. And I don't think we really ever got to how much it would cost if we were to, they put all the statewide offices into a system, or statewide offices plus judicial, statewide judicial races. I don't think we ever costed that out, but that was one idea that we did talk about, so.
I think I would, at this point, I would tend to favor, if we're going to do this as sort of a trial program, of focusing on judicial races, because, one, they're nonpartisan, and two, so you don't get involved in political debates, and two, I'm always find it remarkable when I get my ballot how many individuals are running unopposed for judicial positions.
I think the only concern with doing them with judicial races is that the participation rate is so small. I mean, there's so few donors who give to judicial candidates that, and so few donors who, I mean, so few individuals who even follow judicial races, especially local judicial races, that if you ran a public financing pilot program with judicial races, you're not going to see a lot of people. You probably won't see an incredible increase and the people who are engaged or who participate, and you don't want the program to be labeled as failing or as problematic because you don't see enough people participating in it. So I think that's the problem with judicial races, that you don't, that there's so little engagement there that is a really good place to test whether it increases public engagement versus like a legislative race or a Secretary of State race where you do see more public engagement.
How about a sheriff's race? That could hit the sweet spot between the judiciary and the legislative. Small enough that it's affordable, but actually has, you know, got some public input.
I think what would be a good way of testing what kind of races people we should test out would be to see what percentage of voters participate in those races. So, like, in, you know, a gubernatorial race, you probably have, like, I don't know, what, 70% of people who vote in the gubernatorial races. Versus in the local sheriff's race, you probably only have like 20% or 35%. And that might be a good way of figuring out the metric of where is there enough public participation.
I think it's higher than that, but I say that. I think maybe not Multnomah County, but, you know, having lived in Tillamook County and Deschutes County, those sheriff's races get pretty hot and heavy at a local level sometimes.
it was a surprising experience to me in my wonderful 36-county tour of sitting with clerks and seeing what things look like. How many of the rural counties told me it was the local races that drive turnout? Maybe not in a presidential year, everybody has the interest in the presidential, but they, when they and their expertise are guessing what turnout is going to look like, it was always based on, we've got a hot DA race, we've got a hot sheriff's race, we have something, you know, at the local thing that turns out the voters, which is, like you say, not the case, you know, necessarily in a Washington County, Multnomah County, Clackamas County, where the county government's a little more, you know, a little more amorphous in the minds of folks. But so that was of interest to me. But you are hitting on some factors that would be useful to consider, which is sort of voter engagement in the races, the financing that's needed in terms of the kinds of costs that do. We also do get a lot of complaints about that there's a lot of expenditures. That's one area where we hear from people that people don't file expenditures, you know. So whether we know or not how much money is done in those little bit local races, but at any rate, those are some key factors. I do know there's a little movement afoot to try to work, well, certainly around sheriffs and, you know, raising the profile of law because of the higher profile of those issues. But also a great concern in the legal community about judicial races and a little bit more undue influence because of the limited pot of donors that actually participate in that. So there is a little bit of political momentum there. But it, as you say, it doesn't have the visibility in terms of other voters. But Norman?
I wanted to suggest two other potential sources of funding. One would be similar to the state of Arizona, where they placed a surcharge on all fines in state courts and funded their voter-owned elections there with that. And then another source would be trading it for the political tax credit. There would maybe be enough money and several millions of dollars from that source that we could trade for a more effective, say, matching fund and increase the motivation for people that actually participate in the public financing system rather than the reward coming a year later, as we've talked about, I talked about before.
Others? Anybody on the phone? Seth, go.
So I noticed there's kind of a bullet on the options. Must be voluntary, but can have conditions for participation, requiring some validation of candidacy with petitions or donations. The smaller parties often have difficulty meeting these thresholds, and then they get zero. And so I think it would be important to ensure there's no real validation of the candidacy that's prohibitive. And in fact, in the Multnomah County Sheriff's case, which goes to what we were talking about here, Mike Reese, who was appointed because there's been a continuous series of scandals in that office, the write-in total was 7%, which is very high for a write-in. And the candidate who is running for write-in, Teresa Rayford, would not be qualified to even place on the ballot because they need to have the state police certification to be listed. But even if they were to be elected, they'd have a certain time period to get that qualification later. They can get qualified for that later. So in that case, I would not want to even eliminate somebody like Teresa Rayford with Don't Shoot Portland, who's a police accountability activist, from getting help with their campaign, even if they're rejected from even being able to file due to discriminatory laws.
Okay, and I do think that came up a little bit in our discussion, so... We'll add that into our record. Um,
Yeah, there was lower. You can see what candidates would be included in it. Like the lower section kind of goes back into that. Yeah, there's the bigger number of candidates, the more it costs. But a large number of candidates, I usually consider a good goal to have. We do have a strange election system that tries to eliminate the power of minor party candidates. But as Dan Rayfield's was a petitioner on, we have a movement to get ranked choice voting in this state. So we can see a number of other reforms that make it easier for a large number of candidates to participate. And there's currently there's an effort to do a statewide campaign on ranked choice voting now, too, that we'll be seeing coming up.
This is Brad, Gene. Do you want to comment?
Sure.
You know, one, I'm encouraged that there's interest in looking at these systems and these options, and I think we're all constrained, obviously, by revenue, which is, you know, obviously reality. But still, the interest is a positive step. The devil's in the details. But I'd say, if anything, guiding what I'm hearing is we might have the option to argue for an experiment. And if I know anything from experiments, particularly in this kind of public policy, what can kill an effort in an experiment as much as anything is something that overwhelms those people conducting the experiment. If we are to do an experiment, I think we should get less lost in the details of a perfect level of race. It's kind of like we're setting a standard for what we want to do in a whole system as opposed to setting the standards you'd want to do in an experiment, which is different. And in my mind's eye, an experiment's going to be most successful if it's an opportunity not only to advance a public policy, but also get the kinks out of how to actually do that public policy. So if we're going to do an experiment, I would argue for something with a smaller range of offices, something that lets us test out whether, you know, the mechanics of it, and obviously other states have mastered this. There's no reason why we can't. And also just get familiar with the language of moving, or at least trying to build out this kind of system. I don't know what that office is. I tend to think it's statewide. It, you know, maybe two statewide offices. But again, if we're limited to thinking about an experiment, I think we shouldn't be trying to take a bite out of our larger goal and instead really figure out how to do a good experiment that could have both popular political support and be a real experiment. Have, you know, that's about managing it, not just about what we're trying to get done.
I think one thing to add on the question of pay for by, you know, how we pay for this program is it probably would just be wise if we, you know, maybe if someone, potentially the task force, puts together a table of how other locations pay for it. I mean, like, there's 13 localities. I think there's, like, 13 localities in the U.S. that have public financing. South Dakota and Berkeley and Howard County just passed it this last November. You know, Connecticut and Maine have had it for a long time. And so I think it'd just be a good idea just to put together, like, how every locality pays for it. And I think most of them probably pay for it through general fund, but I'm sure a lot of them do pay through, like, surcharges on, you know, fines and fees. And so it would just be a good idea to get the range of options in place, and that way we could be better informed as we make this decision. Every voice, which is the organization I came in to do a presentation, could probably provide a lot of that information, too.
And we had also had a request into NCSL to see, particularly after this election cycle. And I'm embarrassed. I don't know, Aaron, if you tracked down, how did it come out in Washington?
Did not pass.
It did not pass.
Well,
that's interesting. I won't postmortem that or make any assumptions about it. But
probably too soon.
Aren't we all happy about that? Because when we go up to Washington, we can still...
Yes, as Oregonians, we benefit from the fact that they didn't pass it.
I never shop in Washington.
It did pass in South Dakota.
Yeah, okay, all right.
Really interesting.
Yeah, that is.
So, Madam Secretary, do you think it's appropriate to just briefly discuss what's going on with the City of Portland ordinance? Because I know a lot of people who are... here today did go to that hearing and participate in it. And Just briefly, I don't know how we're doing for time, but I didn't hear the rest of the testimony. I did start off the testimony with support for the ordinance the city is considering. My understanding is that there was a lot of great testimony in support of the city moving forward, but that the negative testimony that came in was largely from the city auditor's office, and that was specifically about administration of the system. So I think, we'd be remiss if we don't spend some time thinking about who would administer a system like this, because especially if you are talking about a local government as opposed to a state government, it's really important that a system be run with accountability and, an adequate administrative setup. And what I gather happened, but this was after I left, is that the auditor came in and said that the auditor's office was not the place to administer a public funding system at the city of Portland. And there has been discussion about whether Multnomah County elections could instead become the venue. So this is an important part of the discussion, and it does, of course, also go to how much it costs to initiate something.
Others have, Norman?
I can speak to that. I listened to the whole hearing. There was not one negative voice, actually. The auditor essentially was saying that she did not have the funds nor the staff to administer the program. And so Amanda Fritz committed to trying to figure out how to administer such a program in Portland. That doesn't mean it wouldn't ultimately land in the auditor's office, but that they would have to dedicate some more resources to doing that, it seemed to me. The whole idea was to provide a matching funds for candidates for city commissioner, and it was very positive hearing. As I said, didn't hear one dissenting voice in the whole, 4 hours of the hearings that went on. So we're hopeful that that might actually be adopted by the city council, and that would be a good experiment.
Did she quantify what the auditor I'm speaking of, was it quantified by anybody what they felt like that administrative piece would be? If not dollar-wise, was there a structural one? Because that's testimony we could get to understand what the case is.
I don't recall any discussion like that. The previous system for voter-owned elections was administered by the auditor's office with the oversight of a voluntary advisory committee. And in my opinion, voter-owned elections failed in part because of the administration. That first go-round was poor, and there was not sufficient thought put into how the system was actually going to be administered in an effective manner. And then when it had problems, and there was this one candidate that had fraud in this, committed fraud in the system, that was corrected by the advisory committee in the next go-round and was, in my opinion, quite clean from then on. But by then it was too late in the public perception. And then when it did come up for a vote, it was right at the beginning of the recession when nobody was wanting to spend any money on anything. And so it failed narrowly with the voters by only 1,200 votes, as I recall. So I wouldn't have thought it would be a failure except for those circumstances.
So the administration is broken down into three different buckets for how this program would work. Bucket one is, there's a volunteer oversight committee, and so staffing that committee is, part of the administrative, effort around it. So staffing the volunteer oversight committee is bucket one. Bucket two is administering the financial part of it. So making sure that candidates, if they qualify for the program and if they turn in donations to be matched, that the city is depositing funds in their account in a timely and efficient manner, so that CANDIDATES have the ability to run sophisticated and modern campaigns. So that's bucket two, is like really making sure that the funds are going out to qualify candidates in a timely and efficient manner. Bucket number three, which is the biggest part of it, is verifying the donations. And so, only individuals who live in the city of Portland have their donations matched. Anyone can give to a candidate, but only Portland individuals have their donations matched. So there's got to be a process for going through and verifying, does this individual actually live in Portland? That process is looking like it might be the county that takes on that process, because they already do a verification process through the county elections program.
Could I ask folks on the phone to mute, if you would? We are getting a little bit of extra noise in. Thank you.
Yeah, so the verification part is the largest part of it, and it looks like the county might be taking that on, because they already have the capacity, or they already have like the structure in place to do that. Los Angeles has had public financing for a while, and they've gotten it down to they can verify one donation every 8 minutes. So they've been able to time it out based on their process. They have a very rigorous verification process. So that's what the state wanted to emulate. I think like that would be a fair model. There's a lot of administrative models out there. So those are the three administrative features. And I think if we were to emulate such a program at the state, you could have them all run under one office, or you could have them all run under multiple offices.
Talk a little bit about, if you know, the oversight committee. What do they have oversight of? Do they set policy? Do they?
Yes.
Hear reports and ask a lot of questions and make it visible. I mean,
yeah,
what's the authority of the oversight committee?
The oversight committee, what it does is it's a series
of
volunteers.
Staff. My question.
It's a series of volunteers nominated, I believe, by the auditor, and then selected by the Office of Neighborhood Involvement, is the current draft code. And what they'll do is they can review how the previous program went. If you run a program in 2018, in 2019 they would review the 2018 program. And then they would write a report about the strengths and problematic elements of it, and they submit to City Council with a series of recommendations about policy changes. The City Council's got to be the one that actually passes those policy changes, but the Oversight Committee has the ability to make recommendations about what the policy, like how would you change the program elements of it too.
Do they direct staff, or is the auditor in there? Because, the policy is obviously set by the City Council. It's reflected in the ordinance. The steps that the staff take on, whether it's the administration or the verifying of donations, kind of flow from that. But there will be some discretion in that. It's not, as I understand the ordinance, it's not going to dictate this is the process that you use. It may have some general terms about that, but not be specific. So I'm trying to figure out who's the boss of that. Is that the auditor? Does staff report to the oversight committee around implementation issues? Or as you say, is the oversight committee really kind of a post hoc review and next steps, group?
I think it just depends on the issue. There's a rulemaking process for after the City Council passes the ordinance. So I think, in some cases, whichever office administers it has some discretion. I think the Oversight Committee does have report backs about how implementation is going. And then in some cases, obviously, in the bigger policy picture, I think the City Council is the one that makes it. So I think it just depends on what the issue places.
We just all know the history and the world on many initiatives that we try to do that oversight committees often feel like they're either not being brought the right things or they're being, you know, asked to do more administrative, or, you know, that those are tough barriers and tough things to do. City of Portland, among all of the government units, knows that history, and I'm sure is trying to be responsive to it.
So that voter-owned election, the advisory committee did not have an administrative role except to sort of oversee the process and then make recommendations for changes. That doesn't mean that it couldn't be different.
Trying to land on whether it does or doesn't, just trying to clarify what the perception is.
We could examine various administrative schemes through other states, I think, in the making our recommendations. This is certainly a very important thing that should be paid attention to in making any recommendation, because how it's administered is just as important as how it actually operates. And as I said, that the administration part of the voter-owned election is actually what did it in through the first cycle in the public's perception of how well it was working.
So, Madam Secretary, I think this is a really good discussion to be having, because one of the things our small group did focus on was, you know, that Portland may well become a pilot if this moves forward. And a lot of the testimony at City Council was that this program should serve as a model to the rest of the state. So I think, you know, it certainly doesn't preclude our having our own recommendations, but it does create an interesting opportunity to look at a system that's being built from the ground up, possibly, during the time the legislature's meeting.
Yep, that's right. And in addition to any possible proposal of actually initiating a program, whether or not we have lots of detail attached to it, but that contains certain things. Excuse me. Well, how rude is it if I do that to the speaker? Huh? Mm-hmm. Sorry. At any rate, in addition to any possible, I'm just trying to think of, you know, what things we want to have on our list to consider for December. You know, one would be to try to at least have a legislative initiative which begins a process to set something up. Another would be a recommendation about how the task force spends its next 6 months and potential extension, if you think that's appropriate, and continues to review particularly what happens in Portland and in these other places, and this is the additional information that we need. That could be, those could be alternative, they could be on top of each other. But am I going down the right path of what you might think would be appropriate for?
Yes.
Received the most yes votes, right? Is that?
Yes, there were only four hard no's. No matter what, I would always oppose public financing. There were gradations. We tried to give people kind of options, because being wholly yes was a little bit intimidating. For some people, hell yes, this is where we got to go. There, we have a few in that category, but others, it's sort of, well, it depends. It depends, and these are factors that concern me. So I feel like if we're going to get a good, broad recommendation from the group, that when I answer the speaker's call, I can say, yes, this is something that you can rely on as representing it, that it's probably in the nature of, you know, if it addresses some of these concerns, we might have a, you know, have a majority in support. And I know that's a slower move than folks have, you know, hoped to be able to do, but I think we're all proud of Portland for trying to take it on again, whether we like public financing or not. It's, you know, there is a
one of our recommendations might be
we like the idea of public financing, but let's wait and see what happens in Portland.
Well, I mean, the vote in Portland is scheduled for December 15th, so...
Which is the day we meet.
Yeah.
Right? Well, we'll just tune in. Well, can we do that?
Yeah,
we'll be there. So,
when I say wait and see what happens, I mean the actual implementation and operation of the
yes, right, exactly.
program.
But knowing whether
so
we have something to watch.
2 years before we get any feedback from what that happens.
And that would be my feeling, too. Let's see how well it works in terms of increasing the diversity of candidates in the city.
I would be reluctant to do that because there's discussion about delaying implementation until 2020 in order to make sure that all the rules are adequately put in place and it's run well. And so that would mean that we're waiting until 2021, which I know that our task force is meant to go on a little bit longer, but I don't know if it's meant to go on for that many years. So
let's make it a permanent agency, shall we?
Earlier, Daniel, there's learnings from all around the country. So why do we feel beholden just to what's going on at the road in Portland? I mean, we've got municipalities, jurisdictions, states that have years of experience with this.
Good point.
So, but I think there's certainly consensus here around to Nikki's point, that this seems to be the number one supported option. So therefore, we are aspiring to do this, even if the mechanism may be the most difficult of the choices ahead of us. But I think another point is that, you know, I personally believe, and I don't know if the group, we can have consensus around this, but, you know, I find it's better in life not to reinvent wheels. And along the point of emulating, I think, you know, we should make a concerted effort to say that actually we're looking to try to borrow the best of what's going on everywhere else rather than trying to come up with something completely from scratch here. And that we're cognizant of, again, the financial constraints. So I come back to this again because I feel like we sort of have kicked this around, and I've advocated one point, Senator Rosenbaum and some others have advocated another about what's manageable. It seems to me that's our primary challenge now is to figure out what can be done in the near term, constituting a trial that is not going to blow any budgets, but is also going to be something that, you know, is proof of concept. I think I threw that phrase out there on the call last time. But anyway, from the business world, proof of concept seems to be something that's, you know, a useful starting point. So,
yeah, I would actually be in favor of working through some policy questions on public financing because, one, it did receive a lot of votes for us to discuss it. Two, it is in line with our general starting principles about what we are here to do in the first place. And three, we have a rare opportunity where we have stakeholders from all across the ideological spectrum in one room talking about campaign finance reform. So I think the legislature looks to us to think through how would a policy work? And, you know, even if it's a question of funding that we have to look into later, I think the policy itself is like, is it a matching program? Is it a voucher program? Is it a grant program? You know, who would it apply to? What would the match rate be? So on and so forth. All these are questions which the legislature looks at us to put together. And we have all these perspectives to the table in order to formulate that. So even if we can't lock down the revenue source, which I understand is very important, I think we still should, you know, I think to respect the core principles of what we're here to do and our time, I think we should be setting aside a task force conversation on what the policy would look like.
Very good. I tend to agree with you, Daniel. I think whatever guidance. I think the disadvantage of this group and the advantage of this group, the strength and the weakness of it, is the great diversity of viewpoints that we did, you know, try to bring to the table, and that to the extent that we have something against what the legislature can measure, you know, where people are, it's going to be helpful despite
If I could add one thing, too. I mean, assuming the task force, as I understand it, has got a sunset at the moment of next June or something. But what goes on sort of beyond next month's recommendations, I would move that this should be the focus of what we spend the next 6 months doing. Because the other things, we have obviously got onto the reporting requirement piece, but to me, those seem sort of far more straightforward. We can put forward the recommendations on those, and to a certain extent, maybe there isn't that much more for us to be doing on them, whereas this, there's a lot to be done that we probably won't all get done in 6 months. But if we were to focus on this entirely, you know, from January, we could make quite a bit of progress on, I would have thought.
So I'm thinking that you'll deserve a break. Great work for these first 2 hours. If you can hang in for a discussion around the reporting requirements. We don't have Representative Rayfield, who, as you know, has a bill that kind of addresses a number of different things, and we'll be introducing it. So I think we'll have an opportunity to look at what he's getting ready. I do have our LC analysis. I chose not to do the money or the time it would take me to get an AG one, but LC's analysis around the former statute we had on attribution of campaign pieces and I actually had maybe my one and only creative thought since we started this group that I wanted to throw at you as one possibility for moving forward on that topic. But perhaps a break until 10 after 11. Does that feel good?
Sure.
Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you all on the phone. Bring them back from their restroom break or whatever. Thank you. I took a little extra time. Appreciate it. So, reporting requirements and penalties work group. We did have, again, I think a really good discussion. Fleshed out a lot of things. Found out even more things that we needed, you know, potentially to look into. Did I leave anybody's name off who did participate in that one? Because my apologies to Andrew that I left this off the other. I think that was the group. I think the overall structure of a little item of this discussion was this tension between wanting to encourage new candidates, wanting to encourage new committees, wanting to encourage small parties, wanting to encourage folks by not having a system that tripped you up and was complex to learn. And we had some very strong voices in the task force that had concerns, not necessarily about the current penalty structure being overwhelming, but that the rules to follow were complicated and that it intimidated people for being volunteer treasurers as well as being candidates themselves. So that when we talked about perhaps strengthening penalties in areas where we felt people were abusing the system, the concern was that we not, you know, end up making it even more difficult for new players to come into the system. And we talked a lot about various people's personal experiences with this or stories from the folks that they work with, and I think got a lot of good support for these concerns. We did, and I noted some of the responses. Is there a way to do a regular English version of the manuals, which I think Jen will tell you they make every effort to do, and have moved to some of those national research groups have talked about ways to point out the landmines, and we have some little graphics in there that try to help people. But statutes are complex, and rules that are come off of statutes, and that's where our manuals are, end up having that same complexity. So anyway, that might be something appropriate to have clarification, to do more outreach and training for treasurers, that was an important recommendation. I think that people wanted to put forward. There's obviously resources involved with that as well for Secretary of State's office, but it's a perfectly fair one to put on the table. You know, that we want penalties that are strong enough to incentivize prompt and accurate reporting. And we had discussion of whether there was a way to identify repeat offenders or folks who were, you know, that where there's evidence they're intentionally gaming the system and somehow select them out to, you know, for special treatment, if you will. I think people understood very well my and what might be election staff hesitation around trying to measure intent when reports are made to them and issues are brought to their attention. Speaking, if it's a crime or if it's a very high civil penalty and we have to demonstrate intent, that can require an investigative, you know, charge that is beyond what our three investigators now, and in any season we're talking about a pretty busy amount of reports that are filed, and that's assuming that we're not moving into the area where the office acts proactively, you know, to as opposed to being complaint driven. But there was, I think, a good discussion, perhaps worthy of more discussion about what might be some ways to identify. Representative Rayfield, and if you'll remember from the reports on the bill that he had last time, modified last time, and is further modifying in preparation for this session, he is proposing that there is an increased fine in a couple different areas, but also that there is an audit process that is set up, trying to identify more serious reporting requirement violations as opposed to just mistakes and errors in putting numbers in that way. So we did discuss random audits versus selective audits. Did have some discussion of the potential for looking at repeat violators. Maybe after the second time, then you're subject to going to look further at you. In his case, some of what he was interested in looking at is some of those more invisible committees that tend to be IE committees, independent expenditure committees, and may or may not, where we may or may not know all of what they're doing. We also had a very good discussion, and I'm sorry Senator Boquist isn't here because we've had this discussion with him for a while now, and I think he understands some of the challenges that we have. Liability for penalties. We have a gap in our statute right now, which we have tried to fill in three separate sessions, I think. And unfortunately, we've gotten weighed down not because anybody opposes what we want to do, but because a relating to elections bill is just an endangered species. You know, the minute it's out there, it's there for everybody to, you know, to argue about and to add their own little things. And we did and had long, quite upfront conversations with Senator Boquist because he had real concern about some of the liability issues, and we just weren't able to get to the final compromise. So therefore, this very obvious thing is kind of missing, which is a challenge. I will say Representative Rayfield, and I don't know that others who were part of that group would have to remind me. There might have been more than one other who had some concern that, in fact, in case of a candidate committee, it should always be the candidate, and I do, as opposed to the treasurer, and I do think that was the effort that was made legislatively. It ended up making all treasurers not liable even for non-candidate committees, and that was our problem. I'm getting that right, Jen? Jen's going to clarify.
Under current rule, the candidate for a candidate committee is the responsible party for any civil penalty. The treasurer of a political committee or petition committee is the person that's liable. So if I'm a candidate and I have a separate treasurer who files late transactions, I, the candidate, am personally liable.
It's coming back to me. His actual position was where who should be responsible for paying it, and his position was that rather than his donors paying that penalty, which would be using the campaign funds themselves to pay the penalty, he should personally have to pay it. I'm not laughing at that because I think it's a bad idea. It certainly has a good philosophical merit. You know, that's a whole other issue. Should penalties somehow come from a different place? We also then talked about and we referred back to a number of the conversations I think that Seth led us in around transparency for the public and the ability of the public to, you know, if the system of reporting is to be helping the public understand who is and who isn't doing right and where money is and where it's not, you know, are there sort of some steps around that? How best do we allow individuals to follow the money? There was, given that we were talking about reporting fines and violations, we focused a little bit more on whether or not that the fines that are imposed should be more publicly shared. I think they are public record, and we do have a monthly, you know, record that's developed, which most of the press knows about, but it isn't something that's necessarily, you know, broadcast in some ways. Suggestion was made of a possible annual report, where then, as it is, if you know, there are some committees for whom there are more than others. But there continue to be, I think, some hesitation all the way along that there are such things as mistakes, and they can even be. I remember the one in my house race, which I will, you know, go to my, you know, deathbed remembering, which is that the very last contribution I got in one reporting period was reported again as the first contribution in the next one, and it was because it was reported twice that it was inaccurate, and it happened to be a decent sized check that for my campaign, and you know, there it was. So you know, the treating errors like trying to hide, you know, in the same way as people are trying to kind of hide things by delaying things, does it has a bad feeling for people, and I don't know that we arrived at the best solution for how to kind of marry those two principles. But and as I say, I think Representative Rayfield has some good thoughts aimed at those things that are kind of invisible, the independent expenditures, which are a little hard to track in his bill. And I don't know if it's fair to speak for the group to say that I think people were at least ready to consider the possibility that there could be different rules for different kinds of operators, and whether that, you know, what that means to the system. So that was the overall discussion. We'd love to hear from folks who weren't part of the conversation about what we missed.
Could I jump in? This is Kyle.
Absolutely, Kyle.
During the work group meeting, we traded some anecdotes about particular transaction filings that may have gone wrong, but I went back and found some data. At last December's meeting, I submitted an exhibit which included a summary of a campaign finance compliance experiment. And if I could, I want to just read a paragraph from it to highlight the importance of making this stuff easier. Would that be okay?
Sure.
overall subject scored just 41% correct, albeit a little better with Colorado disclosure forms, 48%, and a little worse with California forms, 29%, and compliance on Missouri forms of 37%. Further, not one participant scored better than 80% in the experiment. It is particularly disconcerting that subjects could not complete half of the disclosure tasks that were scored, regardless of the state forms. After all, the subject pool was composed of mostly college-educated people, many of whom were pursuing advanced degrees in political science and public affairs. All 255 participants in this experiment would be subject to legal penalties if they were, in fact, responsible for complying with disclosure regulations. I believe this experiment shows that being too tough on treasurers absolutely puts political participants.
And we will maybe highlight after this meeting the document that you drew that from.
Kyle, is that from the report you sent me this morning?
Yes.
Okay. And so, committee members, you sent a report, campaign finance, red tape. It is on OLIS for everybody to read and or download. It was previously presented at an earlier meeting. We did not, and we're not able to highlight it quite as well as Kyle just did. So it is up there to read now.
Okay. It was the December meeting last year.
Thank you.
If we have to look it up in the previous meeting.
Okay. Question, that was a paper-based reporting system, from what I understand, rather than a computerized one like ORSTAR?
Yeah, the experiments were all done on paper.
The one thing, I do think that it was an agreed-upon concern. But I don't think there was any question that people didn't think there was a challenge here for anybody trying to learn systems anew. To me, the one thing that argues for is actually keeping the ability to use campaign funds as opposed to personal liability wherever possible, because there may be a certain cost of doing business. There may be a certain 10% of, you know, that you are going to have to in order to make it clear. I see Jen fidgeting a bit. Is there something you'd like to add?
I just wanted to share that it is permissible for a campaign to use campaign funds to pay civil penalty, just for clarification. If there's failure to pay the penalty with campaign funds, then it is the individual that's held personally liable, just for clarification.
Yes, very good. It's good to know that is the case. As I say, the question came up whether we, should disallow the use of campaign funds because donors don't expect to be paying you to pay fines. And some folks will have a personal ethic that's important to them, that they take responsibility for those. But I think as we intersect that with some of the, mistakes are going to be made, no matter how diligent you are. There may be a reason to keep.
I would have liked to extend that to parking fines back when I was a candidate.
But that applies only to candidates. Yeah, where the candidate would be. That was the discussion. The candidate would personally be responsible for paying the fine.
Right, as opposed to.
And I would echo what you said, Madam Chair, is that the tenor of the discussion was really how to maintain a good reporting and penalty system, but not one that's so onerous that it discourages people with limited resources from getting engaged in the process. And that's a difficult balance to achieve. And as you mentioned, determining intent is always going to be somewhat subjective, and establishing objective criteria is another challenge. But I think the idea was, where you have a pattern of violations, that's the problem. And the audit opportunity can target that.
And I think as Representative Rayfield went through his legislative process last time, he learned and accepted and sort of understood that the kind of public review had been a piece of the statute and eliminated was not something that Secretary of State's office was anxious to return to, because it resulted in a lot of effort to produce reports on every, you know, on everything that happened that was never reviewed by anybody. You know, I mean, it was, you know, in, sort of internally reviewed and got a lot of documentation gathered, but there wasn't, you know, it ended up being not useful. And so I think he is thinking in terms of some random audit or audit at a certain level of, I'm forgetting sort of some of the details of his things, but Seth, go.
I think one thing that might be good to consider as far as the penalty matrix is for many grassroots groups, they'll have thousands of transactions in very short time periods, but if they're doing canvassing and one canvasser turns in their paperwork a week late or something like that, then you can frequently get repeat occurrences of very tiny, pretty small numbers over the years. But would you want to have the penalty matrix consider them all equal, as opposed to a $5,000 check that isn't being reported? So I think that's something to consider for the small grassroots groups, so that they might not fear running in afoul of some of that stuff.
And as a reminder, and again, John will correct me when I say this wrong, the fine is based on a percentage of the amount of the misreporting. So
yeah, there's also a threshold where they don't get fined too, right?
Right, but right. If it totals under $50, right, it says.
But my concern is the repeat.
This was one of the attachments. Okay, so repeats, but maybe with an intersection with size is something.
Nikki, I had an additional question about this topic, and I apologize that I was not able to participate. It's sort of busy.
Yes, we were doing this right in the middle of a big general election. How silly.
One of the things that happened at the last meeting for the subgroups was Representative Mitchell, Dave Ellis, and Justin and I had a discussion around ORSTAR, specifically that there's a really great system that works, but it's like this kind of wonky, trunky kind of system where it's hard to figure out how to use, and you have to like specifically spell somebody's name correctly, and if they go by a different name, all of those things. I was wondering if the group had a discussion about ORSTAR and specifically ways that we can improve the existing system so that folks are able to search.
Dave was there, and so he'll correct me if I'm wrong. I think the my notes only included the pieces about making sure that we had training and perhaps, you know, continuing to work on clarifying and strengthening training materials and so forth. We didn't, I don't think, identify any specific, like, if the system were changed this way, and this way.
I think it was mentioned, but very briefly in passing, that it is an awkward system to use. I've mentioned to you separately too, is putting information on ORSTAR in the voter's pamphlet, because in terms of providing greater public knowledge, recognition that it exists. But
sorry, I'm having trouble hearing the comment. Could you summarize?
I think it was a matter of the, just as you said, Nikki, the wonkiness of using ORSTAR. Is there a way to make it easier to use, and then providing greater public knowledge that it exists? And I would bet I wouldn't even try to guess the percentage of Oregonians who know it exists and have ever tried to use it. I think that goes partially to Seth's comment about enhanced transparency.
So there's kind of two different things that we're focusing on. One is if you're a campaign and you're using it and you have errors or you have problems that aren't identified. And then there's the research function, the ability to go in and see what's happening. Was that the focus of the discussion you all had, or was it both?
Our subgroup, I think, has different political beliefs, and we all agreed that the system could be improved. I would love to, like, I know that this is a separate topic than the one that we're having, but I would love to put it on either a discussion later or just take a temperature check to see if folks could be supportive of a policy that creates better transparency around the existing system.
Hear, hear.
Well, I think it's perfectly relevant to this group and to future steps that might be taken because in our concern about public perception, how well it is known and how well you can reassure yourself about the finances of your candidate or an opposition candidate or whatever, a sense that you can get true information is one of those values. So I do see this as both. It doesn't go to the penalties issue, you're right, and we may have narrowed that our group discussion a little bit too much around that, but I think it would be appropriate to have a recommendation that, between consumer users as opposed to campaign users that also need initial and greater public awareness and understanding of it.
And I think one of the challenges is just that the requirements for what needs to be submitted through ORSTAR, those are fairly demanding requirements, which I think contributes to the challenges with using the system for someone who isn't familiar with it.
That's an excellent segue to the question I was going to raise, which is perhaps a little abstract versus the other things. But I was curious, having not been on that subcommittee, and again, excuse me if this is past history, it was covered off. I'm just wondering whether one of the questions that might have been raised on this up to now has been around the threshold, and I'm thinking of a different threshold than what Seth was raising, just the threshold for candidate participation, because it's quite low, and I think it discourages people at some level from even thinking about running. Somebody that wants to run a fairly low-dollar campaign, if it was a $20,000 threshold or something, they might think about getting in. But as low as the threshold, I don't know if anybody's raised this before or not.
It has been raised. I don't remember if we talked about it in that subgroup or not. Yeah, I think we mentioned it anyway, but it has been mentioned, particularly given that the 750 mark that we deal with now is actually the cost of a voter's pamphlet page.
Right, exactly.
So that's almost everybody, if they're seriously going to be in front of the public, is going to have to at least have that one expenditure. And so, yep, that is another thing to be.
Isn't there another threshold? I'm recalling some $2,000 figure for
certificate of limited expenditures can be used to increase the amount, but then you.
It's $3,500 for that.
$3,500.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, increasing both of those would be a good topic to think about.
One of Kyle's big issues. We can give him something out of this meeting.
Yeah, thank you.
You guys aren't always on the same page, so it's nice to see that come to. No, that did not get into these notes, or if it does, I'm not seeing it right now, and I apologize
and
for
I
that.
And I can say we've just talked loosely about exempting the voter's pamphlet statement filing from that $750, maybe adding that to the list of exemptions. Mm-hmm. We have talked about raising it before, and then we've talked about how the connection between the threshold is tied to the voter's pamphlet, and that last time it was raised was when we raised the filing fee for the voter's pamphlet, which was just a couple years ago. Right. In the legislative session. So we have talked about it in several forums, just never landing on this is maybe the best threshold or if this should be exempted or not.
And we have talked about the fact that the voter's pamphlet cost is kind of, it's a legislatively set amount. It's not something that is done based on budget needs or projected budget needs for production of the voter's pamphlet. And we know that, in fact, it came up this year for the commission, the initiative, the Citizens Commission on Initiatives, because the statute requires the Secretary of State's office to bill them at printing cost for their submission of however many they have to submit. And it's actually, they then pay more than some of the major candidates pay to get into the voters pamphlet, which is, I'm sure, an outcome that was not intended, but it just shows you that there's a big difference between what the legislature has set as the, you know, what should be a cost to candidates to appear in the voters pamphlet. Just understand that's not, it hasn't been based on a sliding scale based on the cost of the voters pamphlet. It actually costs much more to do that, and a continual kind of struggle for the Secretary of State's office is to make sure that the legislature approves a budget which will allow us to pay for the voters pamphlet, even though some people assume that somehow the filing fees do that.
Well, I'm a big fan of indexing all these dollar amounts so that we don't have to continually talk about them. You know, set them at an appropriate level and then let the process take care of itself.
So inflation and size of office?
Yeah, inflation anyway.
So I could see a recommendations or the set of recommendations that kind of go in two directions. One is about you know, steps that might be taken to make the make the information more accessible, visible to the public, and therefore provide the accountability from that direction, and to do with trying to make sure that people are able, you know, to participate, and whether there should be some kind of either ongoing or one-time, you know, focus group, and, you know, a process by which that's evaluated would be a possibility.
I think we might also be able to come up with some recommendations to simplify the reporting requirements, you know, generally speaking.
Do you want to be more specific, Kyle?
Yeah, well, we might decide that in one area the rules are too complex. I know in the work group we had talked about the fact that different committees might have different deadlines for reporting based upon whether they're active or not, and that's something that could be simplified if we wanted to. And there may be some other cases if we you know, go study the problem where we might decide that the rule we have now is too complicated and we could write a simpler rule instead. And if we could do that, then that would always help compliance. You have to teach less because it is simpler.
I have the feeling, just so you know, that there's no reason not to, you know, lay that out for the legislature and have them, you know, try to take a little responsibility for it, but that every time we identify a complexity, there's going to be a counter argument about why it can't be simpler. And not because people love complexity, but because it's some of these different balancing acts that are done. So it feels a little bit like the process that we use to get rid of waste, fraud, and abuse, is you end up circling around the same things, you know, for a long time. So, but recommending that a review you know, again, maybe looking at some of the models from other states and so forth, to see where there is simplification and clarification opportunities is never a bad idea. I don't mean to speak against it, just to understand.
I'm reminded of Einstein's quote about everything should be as simple as possible, but not simpler. But using a computerized system like ORSTAR actually gives us a big advantage, because internally it can be checking on different things that are unreasonable, whereas a paper-based system can't do that. And so, for example, I don't know, size of contribution can't be more than, you know, $100,000. If you put something in more than that, that won't, we'll kick it out, maybe. That's a trivial example, but internally there might be some checks about their account doesn't balance, for example. that's the kind of advantage that ORSTAR can have if we build in some checking.
But, and I think Jen can check me if I'm wrong, but I think that being in balance or being where you should from the first to the last is the one thing that kind of does automatically happen.
Yeah.
What ORSTAR does is that it functions in that it calculates all the activity that's been reported by the committee and filed by the committee in a calendar year on an account summary page. So the key is that the user has to make sure that they're checking the account summary page and looking at the ending cash balance versus what's in their campaign account to see, make sure that it jives, that it equals itself.
Yeah, I thought it did that.
It doesn't look at the checking account, but if
they were required to, say, report the checking account balance, and then if their report didn't balance with that, then that would be something. But I'm just throwing out some possible examples.
But it also can be account summary has a top number where it was before the year started and where it is at the end, and it does note if there's the pluses and minuses don't.
It does, but yeah. The account summary itself is based on the data that the right. transactions that are filed by the user, and so the public and we are dependent upon the user filing the transactions, filing all the contributions, and filing the expenditures, and that the user should be, you know, the whole idea is that one of the line items where it says ending cash balance is what reflects in the committee's campaign account once everything has been entered in ORSTAR. And once everything has been deposited and cleared through the committee's bank account, so it is a common mistake that committees don't look at that particular piece of information.
One thing that would be intriguing for ORSTAR is if you know, a candidate or a campaign had, you know, X number of fines levied against it, you know, for wrongdoing, that that'd actually be an ORSTAR. And so if you go under a candidate's account, you can see, like, so-and-so candidate has 4 or 5 times, you know, violated campaign finance law, or, you know, has had problematic elements towards campaign finance law.
Well, let's say on the report here, 3B.
Well, great minds think alike, clearly.
Yeah.
You know.
I think that'd be a great idea, actually.
Yeah.
I think they just refile.
I'm not sure if all the treasurers and candidates would be happy with that line item.
Again, we come up with the, you know, the mistakes versus the attempt. You know.
So, for any member from our work group meeting, in terms of thinking about task force recommendations to the legislature, how many of these changes we're discussing can be implemented just through administrative rules, and to what requires? Would actually require legislative action. I know the one thing that I remember was that if we were to enhance the audit capabilities or authorization for the Elections Division, that would require enhanced resources. So that would obviously require legislative action. But again, I don't know how many of these things can just be implemented to administrative changes, and again, how much requires more statutory kinds of
how the
actions.
Data is reported. I mean, there's always going to be cost associated
right.
with any change in the system, so just understanding that. But it can be relatively reasonable within current budget, you know, kinds of things versus development of a new module or, you know, really having to, you know, do a complex algorithm to come up with something. In terms of that, so producing the information in a different form is going to be different than requiring new tasks by the users, the campaigns themselves. Even if, I mean, one of the things to think about is that even if a secretary were inclined to try to say this, I think there's authority for me within this statute, I think the legislature would react to any of that, and there would have to be a legislative discussion, understanding that you've got 90 members who all of whom have to have to participate in this system. And so I don't think it's a cynical or criticism of them to say they're going to have hawk eyes on a secretary who decided, I think I've got the authority to say you now have to, you know, give me your bank statements when you didn't have to give me your bank statements before.
But so, making OreStar more user-friendly, for example?
It would depend on the cost, and it would probably not require, it would be the kind of thing where if the elections division were to propose that modules be changed or created, it would probably be something that would have to be contracted to do. It has to get in line for all of the different kinds of fixes that we have for our system, and be that could be a budget package that would be, for instance, our election night reporting, which it actually rolled out.
It's a huge improvement.
Eventually, all 36 counties did it on election night. It was pretty exciting, but that was certainly something that was within our statutory authority to produce. It took a special package to the Ways and Means Committee, and in fact, was something that was very high on legislators' list of criticisms of the our election night reporting, was the fact that you had to go to every county to get the results, and they wanted the ability to have it all in one place. And so, but that was a $350,000 package to make that happen. I could envision something like that.
Yeah.
And we could certainly recommend something that could lead down the path to, you know, an appropriate package being proposed by the Elections Division. Maybe one of the recommendations out of this group would be that, you know, that there be a convening of users of various sizes to evaluate.
So any change is going to, implementing any change is going to require some kind of legislative action, even if it's simply budgetary.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So there's a, one thing that can be done to reduce the budget is work requirements is you could open up the source code to some of this reporting systems. And there's a group called Hack Oregon, which you may be familiar with, that basically volunteered and wrote a whole bunch of software to report on what's going on via OreStar. I've written a whole bunch of stuff that allows me to see what's going on at OreStar. If we had open source access to be able to even just donate to the government code to view results in different ways or star information, then they can be put on as modules and they even be made optional. You can just click on and see what's the Hack Oregon view, what's the Republican Party's view, what's the Democratic Party's view, how are they characterizing each other's reports from the data.
That
could be made
also,
fairly open.
That could be implemented not as contributed software code, but as an API, application programming interface, which you could access the system's data from outside without changing anything. And that would be a big boon also for third parties to get involved in.
Yeah, earlier I've brought up ways to improve the way to download the data. So something equal to an API.
Mm-hmm.
Say the words of API again.
Application
programming interface.
Yeah. The sophisticated computer guy here.
I'm sorry.
Are you going to create the OreStar app for us?
Well, the module goes on top of it. Kyle would definitely volunteer for that. I think he's still on the phone, is he? No. 12:02, he's gone now.
So I think it's fair to say there's a good deal of interest in having in that. And we will have an opportunity to evaluate at whatever stage Representative Rayfield is in his legislation. I think he will be very willing to share, and the task force can decide whether some of his reporting, auditing, penalty things included in his effort to get at dark money, if you will, and see whether or not any of those meet our test of, you know, not making it so complicated that nobody can be involved, but helps to open up what we have considered to be a pernicious problem that is difficult to solve because of constitutional limitations. And if people wouldn't mind staying until maybe 12:15 or so, I'd love to talk a minute about the issue of attribution, required attribution for campaign materials. I understand there will still be disagreement about whether or not the analysis that we have from Ledge Council Committee on what our Oregon Supreme Court might say about a statute like we used to have requiring identification of the source of political publication, but we do have their analysis to work with. I think there's always appropriate periodic reporting opportunity for the task force to continue to reiterate what some of the challenges are to getting at some what many of us feel is affecting public perception, so I don't think we're going to skip over those things, Citizens United and others at this point in terms of reporting. But I did spend a little time thinking about some of the challenges that came forward in my brief tenure as Secretary of State in terms of trying to follow up on complaints filed about campaign literature, particularly unattributed campaign literature, which just the fact that it's unattributed does not make it a violation of anything, but it may have another problem attached to it that could be. And we had one in House District 44 where there was this sort of fake voters pamphlet thing that purported to be what the incumbent candidate really thought or did in that form. It had a seal on it that looked very much like the state seal, and that was an issue for our office because we're in charge of the state seal and what gets to happen. It turns out they had very cleverly used the territorial seal as opposed to the current state seal. Smart cookies. But we spent a great deal of time floundering in trying to identify who might be responsible for this. An attributed material made it difficult for us to, you know, take action. And most importantly to me, made it impossible until such time as people reported expenditures and did specifically reference this material to know whether the expenditure for that material was actually reported. And we've had other examples of that in our recent debate around some robocalls that were made. Some of them were attributed and some of them were not. There's FEC stuff that people are looking at. It's still a little bit of an open question. But again, the question is, if there was information that was, and please don't hear this as a declaration that there was, but because there's a variety of scripts that we had to evaluate. But if there was definitively misinformation about a person's ability to mark a ballot, that's a separate thing that we can enforce. But if you don't know who did it, you're kind of a C in terms of being able to enforce those pieces. And so I did ask Dan Gilbert to, subsequent to this, and he's done a little initial thoughts, but we're not going to put him on the spot to answer the question right now, about whether it would be possible for us to have some very specific reporting requirements that attach to anonymous campaign materials. Wouldn't affect the material as it was perceived by the voter and not necessarily therefore affect their free speech rights that the Oregon Constitution has, but would help us to enforce the other parts of our responsibilities by making sure that, you know, and whether that would be reporting sooner, instantly. If you're going to have an anonymous piece, it needs to be acknowledged now instead of 30 days later or whatever you are in the cycle, whether it has to be identified in a specific way so that we're aware and understand, whether a penalty could be different for the, you know, waiting 3 months to tell people who did that piece over there. I haven't necessarily spun it all out, and I'm sure there's questions or concerns that would be raised about any of that. But I do think it's worth exploring whether or not, because I do think there is good public concern, and we've got a little series of anonymous letters running out to the clerks at the moment. We know not from who, because they're anonymous, talking about, you know, the campaign literature that we can't even tell where it came from, and they're so mad about it. It occurs to me that there may be a window there. Dan has not said, Gene, you're out of your mind. It's, you know, this will hold, and you'll never be able to regulate anything. What in between there is the truth, I don't know, but I'm asking if there is a lack of wholesale objection. It's something that I would explore for maybe a more specific proposal to be added to the list.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think that's something Common Cause would be really interested in exploring too.
The focus is on visibility of who's making expenditures, right, as opposed to necessarily affecting the content of the campaign.
And so, I mean, I think, you know, there would be a lot of interest in that, because we are one of only three states that doesn't have paid for by statements on our campaign materials, or doesn't have the requirements. I was wondering what thing you could do. I'm not sure what the cost of this would be, but instead of having paid for by on the materials themselves, what if you know, because, like, when you go into Orstar and you see that Candidate X has, you know, paid $10,000 for a campaign ad, that's all you see. You don't see what the ad is. You just know that they paid $10,000 for a campaign ad. How cumbersome or expensive would it be for a requirement that if you report an expenditure over $1,000, that you have to, you know, it's an ad, you have to upload a copy of the ad into Orstar? Like, would that be something that could be implemented?
Or link
make
to
the
it.
Ad searchable also.
Yeah.
So that people had a question about a particular ad, they could then find it in Orstar.
So if I went under, like, all the candidates, you know, if I went under Canada X, I could see all the ads that they had paid for on Orstar.
Well, and what's, it's not just candidates. In many cases, that this is really going to be
independent expenditures.
Sure, that's who. Just an example.
That this is one of the ways that the third party stuff comes into play.
So that would, we already have the requirement for disclosure of expenditures that are for different candidates and independent expenditures. This would be just tying the actual media to the expenditure.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't have anything to do with the content of the media or the advertisement. So I think it would be constitutional, in my opinion. But
I'd like to point out, if we add additional things to Orstar, but the problem of, like, being able to search Orstar isn't solved at first, then we're still going to have a problem of increasing reporting, but the
Brandon.
Same people that don't have access to that are still going to be limited. So I would just, I know that this biennium or this, we're going to have budget deficits, and as we think about proposals, I think it is important to think, if people don't know about Orstar, but then adding additional things to Orstar is added, I think, like, we get into some of the situations. It's just the only thing I would like to
do. Yeah, I'd be hard before horse.
I absolutely agree, and I'm not putting this up as an exception to that rule. I think we have to think about it in a package together. I do think of this less as an Orstar issue in terms of the public knowing, as I want to think about this in terms also of our ability to enforce the current reporting laws. I mean, it's a barrier to our ability to enforce them. And there may not be either a simple or easy way to kind of get at that, but I'd like to have a little bit of time to explore that.
And I would echo Nikki in the sense that we were just earlier we're talking
Gene,
about
I think it's
this.
A great idea, and I'd hope we'd explore it thoroughly.
The awkwardness of using OrStar, the more you add to it, the more challenges it creates for people to use it.
I think, you know, one thing that made me think about is, yeah, OrStar is cumbersome and accessible for a lot of people. Really,
I think
easy.
It's a great idea. I just think it's
important. Yeah, no. You definitely
yeah,
like think about it at
the clunky part first.
Yeah, and like it is, you know, it's a clunky part we really do need to work through because it is inaccessible to a lot of people. I think one advantage of, like, you know, I remember from the District 44 fake voter pamphlet ad, there were all these articles that came out from, like, the Oregonian and the Willamette Week about who was responsible for it. And, you know, there are, there are certainly individuals like the media or obviously candidates running for office who could, under this proposal, go and look in OrStar and, you know, track down who is responsible for the ad. You know, and I think that takes away from your point that, like, it is a clunky system that we need to be updating to, but it also does allow for, public, if we do this plan, it does allow for, like, some public oversight over what ads are being distributed.
So, yeah. So would you require that they change the filing deadline to be the day it runs for these particular cases?
I don't know. Yeah, that's the
because if you give if you say, oh, well, just go look on OrStar, and then they have to wait a week or a month.
And I want to think about it just with this hat on that I have until the end of the year from the standpoint of I have other laws and the requirement to report to enforce. What's a tool that will give us the opportunity to do that? I think most folks who do, obviously, like with everything else, if somebody's determined to do it anonymously and they're not going to tell anybody, they're not going to follow that rule either. So, you know, if there's a dishonest, intent behind it, but. In the ability to be able to identify what has happened is completely impaired in that case because the material doesn't give us what we need to do the research and investigate what's happening. And is there a way, whether or not it appears immediately in OrStar for media and public view, is there something that the Secretary of State's office can have in order to, what are you going to do about, look at this, and we've got a piece of paper in front of us, we have no idea who did it, and, relying on sort of tips from here to there, and somebody had it, saw a box of them on a platform someplace, and, it was an amazing sort of set of circumstances that was hard to do. And ultimately, a national group did come forward and say, we did this, they said they did it in, I can't remember, please, reporter, don't put this out here as my summation of the case. I'm just saying the process at the time was very cumbersome and at a time it's very high stress for anybody involved in these races. And I just wonder if there's a way to get around the attribution issue and not violate the First Amendment right for anonymous speech, but somehow be able to enforce it. Kyle was probably having a stroke.
I think an important question is, should we be assuming OrStar should be the tool to track on everything that every candidate and every campaign is doing?
Yes.
Okay, that's putting...
So
that's putting a pretty incredible burden on OrStar.
As a database person... Putting stuff in a bunch of databases is never a good idea.
Yeah, I understand that.
I think,
what about on paper in a file?
You could limit it to, certain, maybe ads over the cost of $2,000.
And again, it goes back to the question of the more you load onto it, the more difficult it is for people to use it and get usable information out of it.
Well, thank you. I've used a lot of your time today, been a really great discussion. I will make an effort at some initial areas where we might have some resolutions that might either lead to legislation or other recommendations for us to kind of get ready for. But please don't ever hesitate to send us stuff in between. Norman.
So I wanted to comment on this opinion that we obtained from Legislative Council. I'm not sure I agree with this. I'm not an attorney, so I can't criticize the detail of it. But this was evaluating a new statute, which was essentially the same as the old statute.
Which was what we asked.
And so it leaves open the question of, could we write a new statute that might be modified in some way to make it constitutional? And so just in the same idea that we were just discussing, that disclosure on ORSTAR of campaign advertising attribution may be constitutional because it has no relationship to the content of the speech, we might be able to write an advertising attribution statute in such a way that has nothing to do with the content of the speech and thus still be constitutional. And, you know, they've got this Robertson test with three categories. Maybe we could write it in such a way that in the context of a campaign disclosure law where the public has a right to know who's trying to influence their elections, that we might actually fall under one of the other categories of this Robertson test and thus become constitutional. So those are the kinds of things I think we could ask Legislative Council to actually consider a statute that would do that for us.
And I think that's one of the advantages of having the analysis in front of us, understanding that another lawyer might have a slightly different analysis of it, is to do exactly that. So I would say feel free to think about what alternatives like that might be. I came up with the one that I did. But there may be others, and I really do think.
But there's a big advantage to having the attribution right on the ad, because it then informs the public immediately rather than having to go through.
And a broader set of the public.
Yeah, but broader set of the public.
Right.
And the example was that might justify this is the Bay Area campaign. I forget the exact
Richmond, California.
Yeah, Richmond, California, where a lot of oil companies ran ads anonymously against it, and or rather with it, the attribution, and that turned the tide in that particular ballot measure contest.
I just wanted to quickly mention here for the video some of my objections to the letter.
Disagreements. Okay.
Yeah, disagreements. First, the one already mentioned, that it only deals with the named or implied within the statute itself. So it's only talking about the one statute. I mentioned that in an email. But if you look at the three different tests, there you could argue in all three different cases that the law would be okay, in particular because the historical exception actually already exists for restricting anonymous speech in certain ways. ORSTAR itself prevents anonymous speech. That's the first framework of Robertson. The second one is if you direct it against the pursuit of a forbidden effect, then all you have to do is put the statute in to say it pursues terms against the pursuit of a forbidden effect, and that forbidden effect is getting around the anonymous speech thing that ORSTAR already handles. So if you look at ORSTAR, it's trying to get people to be non-anonymous and be responsible for their speech as the Constitution allows them. It requires that people be responsible for their speech. And the third section of Robertson is against causing the forbidden effects. So this is more direct than pursuit of forbidden effects, but against causing of forbidden effects. This also, ORSTAR also, like if you were to do this, do anonymous speech and not report in ORSTAR, then that would be forbidden. It would be directly forbidden. That you know, you're getting around that in a way. So I think you could argue that it could be under any of the three categories. A new statute would work fine.
Somebody might argue the other way, which is that Orster's requirement is unconstitutional. But I get your point,
yeah,
and that is that since Orster is already a baseline, and that certainly was part of what I was thinking in terms of for acknowledgement, there must be some attachment. There must be some analysis that explains why that's the case, and can we piggyback on that to move to something else? I think it'd be helpful, and I'm certainly happy to talk with Dan, and not that we have unlimited access to his time, but to think about the variations around that. But think about, what that might look like. I think we'd be more successful, given that we have some pretty, it isn't disagreement with Dan so much as disagreement with the court and what they've said previously, even though it's been some years. If we accept their analysis, even though we think it's wrong, we accept it. What is possible within that? And I think that continues to be something that we ought to think more about. And like I say, I made an effort at that.
So, Secretary Atkins, I think that as a final topic today before we disband, might be useful to have a discussion what we need to accomplish in the interim before our next meeting so that we can be efficient in accomplishing a recommendation to the legislature at our December meeting.
Well, it would be my proposal that, or as I said at the beginning, was to working from the discussion that we've had and where it appears we have more than, a divided view, or a little less divided view than we have on our original things, building off of our original report, that I would prepare a series of possible either recommendations for legislation or recommendations for steps that might mm-hmm. not be bills, which there seemed to be a cross-section support. How much before our meeting that could be accomplished, so have to be scared about getting it done in enough time for you to have a lot of time to think about it. But we have a 3 or 4 hour block that we're in, and we have some scheduling difficulties that have arisen because of the Portland City Council will be meeting on that day to discuss this issue, it appears, and so people are going to be conflicted. Coming up with another meeting time could be a challenge, but we'll work on that one first.
And currently we are set for the 15th of December from 9 to noon, and
yes, there is.
My understanding from Daniel is that the Portland City Council will be meeting that day to vote on public financing program, whether it's in the morning or in the afternoon, is yet to be determined. So it may not ultimately be a conflict. Daniel and I are certainly going to stay in touch. And if it truly does pose a distinct conflict in which multiple members aren't going to be able to be here, in deference to that, we can maybe see about Friday that same week. So maybe the 16th. I would hesitate.
Just move to the afternoon rather than the morning?
We could, and that would be the other opportunity.
Welcome.
Exactly.
Driving in from Bend. I'd prefer that.
So,
afternoon is better for somebody.
It would be useful to schedule it from 9 to 1 because we'll need maybe a little more time to work through the different recommendations. And then I think it would be useful for us to renew the recommendation for a constitutional amendment to enable campaign contributions. We haven't discussed that since.
I was oblique about it, but yeah. But I do expect that to be on the list determine whether there's a change. As I say, I think what legislative leadership, if they're going to take any action, in a quick form. They're looking for more of a consensus than we were able to produce on that issue. But repeating the majority viewpoint is not, and the minority viewpoint on that issue is an appropriate thing for us.
In light of the Multnomah County Charter Amendment, 89%, I think that would be almost imperative for us to renew that recommendation.
Thank you for your good work. I too feel anxious about, having a lot of possible recommendations in here and how specific we are ready to be about them. But we'll do our best to do some interim work that'll be back.
And one other thing that was on my mind that if I could suggest that we formally invite Secretary-elect Richardson to our next meeting.
Well, as you're aware, one of his transition team was here. I let them know what our next meetings would be and invited the participation in any way that they do. And I'm not giving up my gavel till I give up my gavel, which he understands, completely. So whether he is able or wants to attend on to himself.
Well, it doesn't have to be formal, but it might be a suggestion that we'd
I'll let
to
him
have
know
his
that
opinions.
The task force is interested in hearing from him about that.
Okay.
I laid a lot of stuff on him yesterday, and his team is working through a lot of things. So I just, know transitions are happen very quickly, and so
others on it.
Good.
Prepared, but thank you.
Thank you for your work
invitation.
On this, Secretary Atkins.
Oh, thank you. Do I need to say we're going to adjourn the meeting? Thank you all very much. Do I need to say we're going to adjourn the meeting?